Welcome back to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Joining me in the studios is CBS Interactive, my co-host as ever, Fleischman Hillard's VP of Digital Media, Scott Rohde.
Hi, Tim.
And National Content Director of the Australian Radio Network, Duncan Campbell.
Hi, Tim. How are you?
Welcome along. This week, the banks go to war and we love it. Ben Elton, Hitler and Hamlet. KFC, bags healthy eating. What's that all about? And why don't the public trust the media? So first we turn to Duncan. Relatively recent arrival, ARN. What are your priorities going to be? What have you been up to so far?
Well, I arrived on August the 30th last year.
Relatively is a bit harsh, actually, isn't it, now, as we're well into 2011?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. It seems like I've been there for a long time now, but... the first priorities were fixing, getting the repositioning mix in Sydney and in Melbourne. So we did a lot of research into the market late last year, and then we repositioned both those stations on the last sort of off. The mix in Melbourne was repositioned on the 14th of December, and then musically, and then mix in Sydney was repositioned on the 20th. And the other big challenge was, of course, to find a breakfast show for Mix Sydney. Mm. So that it was an interesting last part of the year, because it was a combination of the science of radio and then the art, of course, trying to find a breakfast show, which was a lot of fun.
Let's chat about the breakfast show in a moment. One of the things I was going to ask you is, when it comes to programming music, for instance, how much is about who your audience is, and how much is it programming to where there might be a gap in between rival stations, for instance?
Well, it begins with finding the gap in the market, so that's what we had to do. Mix had gone fairly young and sort of hard up against Today FM, and to be fair, was a poor imitation of Today FM. So we weren't getting any traction with that at all, or they weren't at the time. So we knew we had to move the station. So the first step was to find the gap in the market, which was difficult because Today FM is such a strong radio station, and WS, which is part of our stable, is also a strong station.
Which is the Sydney WSFM.
Yeah,
station.
WSFM, but at the thank you, but at the top end of the target, and so we had to program as a duopoly. If we didn't have WSFM in Sydney, we would have, targeted Mix probably very differently. But so we had to find a gap. And because the images were lacking and the position was lacking, it was difficult. So the first step is to find the position. Then we went and tested the songs for the demographic.
And how would you define that position?
Well, it's the bullseye would be 35-year-old females, yeah.
So playing Young Hearts Run Free every 5 hours or something?
Oh, no, I'd say every 90 minutes.
I remember, and you've obviously worked in the UK radio market as well, I remember someone telling me the secret of Heart FM in the UK was you were never more than 2 or 3 hours away from Candy Stat and Young Hearts Run
Free.
Yeah,
that's right.
So
that's right.
What are the kind of, are there similar cornerstone tracks for you?
Well, there's probably artists. Obviously the big artists for us, Katy Perry, Pink, etc. I mean, they test through quite a broad demographic, so... But we found a fairly, I wouldn't say it's a unique position, but it's a good position that we can call our own, the 80s, 90s and now. No one's really doing that at the moment. So, and we've positioned ourselves sort of at the top end of Today FM's target. So, and at the very bottom end of WSFM's target. Mm. So, that's the music's the foundation, which we've spent a lot of money trying to sort of lay and make sure it's right. But, music only takes you so far these days, so obviously the talent, et cetera, is going to be important.
Now, in Sydney, you're currently doing about the last round of survey delivered about a 3.9, which was kind of standstill. What do you think? What's your target?
Before they shifted the station and it went younger, Mix was doing sixes and sevens and, sometimes up into the high sevens. So, we want to get back to that. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly, sixes and would be good for us. And, you know, we're at the low end of where we are. Obviously, 3.9 is not desirable.
And I suppose in the 25 to 39 year old group, so that was 5.8 this time, which actually had actually gone down a bit. Which I guess suggests that whenever you newly position, you always churn through the.
There was a fair bit of churn going through Mix the last quarter of last year, because we did shift the station when I first got there, just to try and take it away from that very young sound. But the final positioning didn't really take place till sort of December 20, which was out of survey. So in that last quarter, there was a lot of loss 18-24s as they spilt off because the format had changed. We're in the first half of this year is really about rebuilding the station.
And how about WSFM, for instance? I don't want to focus too much just on Sydney, but where would you like your heartland to be for that?
Oh, the heartland for WS is really, I'd say, 40 to 54. But you know, the bullseye there is probably sort of 45-50 really.
And in that age group, you're doing about 12%, which you must be pretty happy with.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can do better. I think all the ARN stations, not just in Sydney, but also in Brisbane and Adelaide, we can do better. And that's because I think we can get smarter with what we do. We're sort of looking at the markets more strategically, and which is where it all begins. And getting that right, getting the strategy right first. And I think we're confident we can get more growth out of these stations.
Now, as a journalist who's sort of been in this market writing about it for about, I guess, 4.5 years now, to me the visibility has always been about DMG and Austereo, and much less ARN. It's kind of almost flown under the radar. In terms of visibility to the market, is that something? Do you think it's got some way to go? That have you started that journey?
You mean in terms of marketing?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I think the board, I think, had lost confidence a little bit in ARN over the last few years, because they were sort of knee jerking to sort of react to market forces. So there is a lack of confidence in that. I think that what we've said to the board is we want to make sure we get the stations right first. And there's certainly more money this year than there has been for a long time for marketing. But I think we've got to be careful about when we sort of put that out in the marketplace. At the moment, you've got Triple M on TV, you've got Nova on TV, I think you've got 2GB on TV in Sydney alone. And Nova's got quite a big outdoor campaign going. So it's quite a crowded marketplace at the moment, so we've got to be careful when we do our marketing. We don't get drowned out by other players.
And I guess you've got to be happy with your product is the finished.
Yeah, and that's the first thing. I mean, Mix Sydney and Melbourne only repositioned late last year, so it's still early days. But we're confident in the music product. We just got to make sure that our talent is delivering what we want them to deliver.
Well, let's talk about Sydney Breakfast. I guess that's been the biggest decision so far, is picking your breakfast team for that, which is Claire and Andrew, Andrew and Claire, whichever way you choose to put it. What's the thinking in that combination?
Well, we wanted to be do something different. I promised the board that we'd get a breakfast show by the end of the year, and on the air by the first survey of this year. It would have been easy to go and hire people who've been on the radio before, or even an existing team. We certainly had lots of interest and lots of applications, but I really wanted to try something different. We simply started off with a really long list of people, and then we went to agents, and that list became much shorter because, the desire to do breakfast radio is not necessarily high. But
I guess the commitment is getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, it is. So, but I saw Claire Hooper on a YouTube video, and she was on the original list, and I listened to the YouTube. I think it was a Good News Week segment. And I just thought there was something, interestingly quirky about her. Not too out there that it wouldn't relate, but there was just a nice sort of side to her, which I thought was very appealing. So she sort of remained on the list from the very beginning. And Andrew Rochev was there as well. He didn't come to the top till a bit later on, but and they hadn't met till November last year.
Despite, I guess, playing their trade with 10, I suppose.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, how do you, that chemistry that you need to get when you get two new presenters in for that kind of thing? I mean, how do you know it's going to work?
Well,
We
did do lots of tests, yeah. The first step was to get them to meet each other, obviously. So there was a very nervous meeting in, from our point of view, in Melbourne at the Como Hotel.
Just take them out and get them drunk.
No, I didn't actually go. They just went, and we sat waiting for the phone calls from the agents to see how the meeting went, and because we knew if they didn't like each other, there was no point carrying on. But they got on really well. A 20-minute coffee ended up being a sort of 2-hour chat. So then it was a case of putting them in the studio to see whether we could hear the chemistry, and that's where the art comes in. I mean, there's no formula for success, as radio history will tell you. And you can't really focus group that sort of stuff. I mean, listeners can't tell you what they don't know. So you have to listen for the chemistry, and it was there. I think, you know, they sort of got on very well, and they were different enough, but they liked each other. So it wasn't going to be a love fest on the air, which I didn't want. I wanted to have a contrast, and there certainly is. Andrew's quite intrigued by the way Claire thinks, and early days yet. But the biggest issue has been that none of them have done radio before, or neither of them.
How much production resource have you got behind the scenes there?
Quite a bit. There's three. There's an executive producer, and there's three assistant producers. So for us, for ARN, we've resourced the show quite well.
And how does that compare to Melbourne, for instance?
Melbourne's got sort of two, sort of an EP, and then two other producers. Mm. So it's one more than Melbourne, but. We just felt we had to put the resource behind Sydney at this point.
What's the next big priority for you then?
Well, it's consistency, really. In terms of Sydney and Melbourne, it's consistency and developing the talent. We're very confident in Bridge and Limo in Melbourne as a breakfast team, and we're working with them quite a lot at the moment, and also working with Andrew and Claire.
Yes.
The next stage is really the strategic look at Brisbane and Adelaide, seeing where we can get growth out of those markets. And for Classic Hits and Gold, or for WS and Gold, it's really a case of, again, just fine-tuning that.
Now, Classic Hits, I remember somebody, and it's a rival, so absolutely a vested interest. I remember them talking about one of the shows on Classic Hits, and it's probably unfair to say which one, but saying, oh, they sound a bit complacent at the moment. I think that's going to change. And they were talking about you coming in as the reason it was going to change. Is that a fair observation? Has there been some complacency?
Oh, yeah, I think there's been a lot of complacency, yeah. Absolutely, yeah, very fair observation. So, and look, I don't want to talk too much about the past, but, I mean, the future is about, you know, people being more accountable for what they do, you know, from program directors, you know, right down through to the talent as well. You know, there's a repositioning not just of the stations but of ARN itself. So, you know, it's the new ARN for us. There's a new culture within. You know, Kieron Davis is the CEO, very dynamic and very driven. You can't help but get swept up by his sort of enthusiasm and desire to win. So, and there's a really, really good positive vibe, I guess, within ARN at the moment, which I don't think has been there for a long time.
And you sort of grew up within Australia as a radio professional, but you also did a chunk of time in the UK as well. Did your time in the UK change your outlook as a programmer?
Yeah, I guess it may be a little bit more measured in the approach, because, you know, the English don't like people thundering down corridors and being too. Too emotional about things.
I don't know. This is too English a question, probably. But were you there in the times of Kelvin McKenzie and Talk Sport Radio?
Well, he was probably he was probably more Australian than most of the English, really, because he did he did tell it exactly like it was and ruffled quite a few feathers. But
and you were programming to a regional network.
Yeah, so. It was a regional network that ended up being about 39 radio stations at the end before the final merger of GWR with the Capital Radio Network.
And you worked in Scotland and England. Did you find a difference there in the way it was handled?
Yeah, well, I worked for Bauer, which is a privately owned German company in Scotland. So,
an Australian working for a German company in
Scotland.
Well,
I was told I was the perfect person because my name was Duncan Campbell, which was about as Scottish as you can get, but I wasn't English, so the Scottish would like me.
So let's not discuss.
Yeah, let's not. We shouldn't go there too much, but... no, I found Scotland fascinating, and the big thing was that the great divide between Scotland and England. As a Australian who went over there, I thought, well, it was all the United Kingdom, and everyone got on very well. But I think if the Scottish could build rebuild Hadrian's Wall, they probably would.
Yes, it's not even Sydney-Melbourne rivalry.
No, really. No, it's far greater than that. But I had a tremendous time in Scotland. And
I guess one of your colleagues, were sort of certainly once the GWR merger had taken place, would have been Paul Jackson, who of course now I guess is your deadliest rival at DMG, or very, very nearly. Did you have much to do with each other when you...
I wouldn't say deadliest rival. He's Nova's different target to us, and there's not a huge amount of crossover, more crossover with the Austereo stations than with Nova. But we crossed very briefly as the merger took place between the GWR group and the Capital Radio group, and he was brought across from Virgin to look after the Capital at the time.
And so. I guess Virgin had a similar position to Classic Rock would have here, or maybe Triple M.
Probably more Triple M, to be honest. Yeah. Mm. So, and then I was in Birmingham at the time, and then I left. So I think we met probably twice. So yeah, once in London, and I think once in Birmingham.
And have you met since you've been back in Australia?
No, we haven't. But
do you have cross paths with your sort of rival program?
We're gonna have a drink one day, but we just haven't got around to that yet. So.
And what's it like? Because I get the feeling that, certainly if you look at our comments thread, the rivalry between Oz Stereo and DMG is that there is an undercurrent of bitterness at times. It's serious. Do you guys sort of, are you off to one side slightly, not joining in, or is it going to become just as bad tempered with you as well?
No, I've sort of I've mellowed a little bit over the years, but still fiercely competitive, and ARN will be fiercely competitive as well. But I think there's we're all a bit older now. I mean, a lot of the guys at Austereo I work with at B105 and Triple M, and so we're all we're all a bit older and wiser, and I think there's a mutual respect amongst us, but that doesn't diminish the level of competition that there is.
And which of the rivals, which ones do you feel are going well, and which ones sort of need some work at the moment, do you think?
In terms of stations?
Yes.
Well, I think you're going to be the judge of that one, so I'll let the audience be the judge of that one.
It was a question that was certainly worth asking. Well, next we talk Battle of the Banks. So last Friday, NAB kind of played a bit of a trick on Westpac into helping promote its consumer push, at least on Twitter. And then they really escalated the war. Now, Scott, let's get into this campaign. What do you think?
It's a strange one. Look, I think it's getting a lot of coverage. There's a lot of people talking about it, which is obviously what their plan is. They want people to let people know what they're doing is. But I'm not really sold on. I think it's more the YouTube stuff I'm not sold on, because
let's take it sort of part by part. Yeah. So let's start with the Twitter.
So thing. I saw their tweet on the Friday around half five.
And for people who didn't see it,
They were saying basically somebody they know has broken up with someone else. And
yes, it's like so it's like really stressed. Think I might have to make a tough decision and part with someone. So of course. You sometimes see a tweet like that from a big brand, and you tend to assume that
it was a mistake.
It's a mistake. Somebody's meant to log on to their personal account. So, of course, it was much retweeted.
Yeah, and everybody's like, oh, never mind, we've all been there, blah, blah. It was probably half and half of people going, hey, you should be tweeting your more corporate stuff from this account. And there are people saying, hey, I'm so sorry for you. Can we help? Blah 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 blah.
And then, most hilariously of all, of course, Westpac joined in and replied and said, we know how you feel.
Yeah. And they were trying to obviously jump the bandwagon and make it look, you're looking like an idiot.
Yeah. And then because Westpac, of course, were the ones that a year or so back did accidentally send a I'm so over today type message.
And then obviously the next day, NAB revealed this website with the
breakup.
Yeah, the breakup thing.
And it also broke in the paper. And this was the thing. Again, so we've already got this social media thing. Next part, the piece that broke next was front page of certainly here we are in Sydney, the Daily Telegraph and other news limited papers around the country, the splash that this is what NAB's doing, they're going to start paying exit fees, and it was the front page. So good piece of PR.
Very good. See, the whole thing was a very strategic campaign. You know, you start with that little top of the pyramid, and it starts trickling down into larger and larger pieces of coverage, and it was really well handled.
So I mean, how will it have come about that that story ended up on the front page of the Telegraph?
Somebody from the PR department have sold it in, said, look, we've got this story, we want to give it to you exclusively. I don't know if it was done exclusively or not. But
I think it wasn't exclusive,
in that case,
yes.
You say, we've got this, and then obviously some negotiations were done. Good enough story, get it in the front page. They know it's going to run the front page, so get the tweet out beforehand. You know, get build up the momentum, and then obviously it kicks off there. And then you follow that, and it's similar. If you look at it, it's probably similar in execution to the to last year's Old Spice, where you had the initial video, then you had the subsequent two more ads, and then you know the whole pushing out across so many different areas. And you know, this led, started on Twitter, led into traditional media, grew online, and then obviously they push out with the YouTube videos.
And that was the thing. So the next stage came on. So throughout the Saturday, the Sunday, and the Monday, it was a news story. Then on the Tuesday, the ads started to break. The long copy ad saying, hey, we're breaking up. So that was almost the next stage, traditional advertising.
Yep.
Well-written long copy ads, I thought.
Very
well-written
copy, actually.
Just that idea to put in people's minds, actually, maybe I am being badly treated by my bank. Maybe I will think about moving banks.
Yeah. The only thing I wasn't a fan of was the YouTube videos.
Well, that was next, wasn't it? So that was on the Wednesday of this week, or possibly even on the Tuesday night. Yes, because it was there were two types of videos. The videos they shot with hidden cameras across Australia, 50 or 60 locations of couples apparently splitting up on Valentine's night, you know, in bars and restaurants and stuff. So those all went up onto YouTube.
Yep.
Those were created by, but the main stuff, by the way, is created by Clemenger BBDO.
Yep.
These were created by a little production company called Willow Rook, of which I don't think they're directly involved, but some of the people involved in that are the Chaser guys.
Yeah.
So they were kind of involved.
Well, I don't really like those ones, really.
But then there were some so-called hidden camera stunts on Rivals. So let's get to that.
Yeah, that was the one that really annoyed me because, you know, they like, for instance, they've got a bunch of guys in and waiter outfits going in with a cake, and then they got to, supposedly got up to CBA staff's event and going in and then just, you know, breaking up them type thing. And
so you know, it sort of went on YouTube labelled, you know, interrupting Combank staff at a long lunch. And it was at a restaurant, and it was just sort of a table of six or seven people. They then arrived. Three or four people dressed as waiters or whatever sang a song, presented the cake, saying you're dumped. They all looked horrified. And the thing was, you couldn't actually tell whether it was real or fake.
Yeah, but it's fake.
Yeah, I rang up Combank.
Yeah, and I think that's what I have my issue with. If it was not fake, then that'd be brilliant. And that'd actually be a prank. But all they've done is, well, tried to pull the wool over people's eyes because the
now,
whole...
isn't it playful enough?
No, see, I don't think it is. I think the point is, the whole point about social media and using social media is honesty, you know, and I think that...
So what about that original tweet that I'm thinking of breaking up with someone?
I don't think that was... Well, that's actually honest because they were thinking about that. But to go in and do that, I think it's the whole...
But the intention was to fool people on
Twitter, absolutely, yeah.
It?
And it's still, and it was there, but it got pickup. But the whole video series is where I had an issue with because there wasn't the actual NAB, it wasn't the actual CBA, and... You know, people will watch that and think it was and be like, oh, good on you for, you know, banks being clever and all that kind of
and
stuff.
And there were three in that series. So there was one which was the restaurant scene. Another one was apparently the ANZ staff are out for a lunchtime sale on Sydney Harbour, which I suspect doesn't happen that often.
No.
And they, you know, they went past on another boat with a sign on it. But again, the giveaway there seemed to be a hidden camera on both boats.
I think my main issue with it was it felt like we're getting... It was getting towards that US style of advertising where you can slam the opposition. And I think that's a bad route to go down.
Well, and then just to mention, the third ad was people sort of coming down on a window cleaner cradle and apparently interrupting a Westpac board meeting.
Yeah.
And again, hidden camera apparently in the boardroom.
Yeah.
But not real people.
Yeah, I mean, those ones were my issue. But the rest of the campaign, I think the campaign's solid. I just have that issue with those ones.
And is it okay to attack other brands?
I think I don't really like the idea of attacking our brands. I think if you can't prove yourself and your brand through your own products, then you know, remoting to attack, you know, having to attack someone means that you're failing in your core programming. I suppose if your product's good enough, you shouldn't have to attack someone.
Now we've seen Westpac respond almost straight away. So when the single page breakup ads were going in, Westpac had double page spreads promoting their, you know, cheaper mortgages.
Yeah.
Whereas ANZ and CommBank have more sort of stayed above the fray.
Well, I think Westpac had to do
What would you do though if you were these other brands? Do you respond or do you stay back?
Well, I think they had to respond. You know, I think they had to say, well, you know, we're doing this or we're doing that.
So CommBank and ANZ have made a mistake by not getting involved then.
I think they'll still continue their advertising strategy, and they'll all come up with different ways to try and lure customers in. I think today's big announcement is obviously the fact that they might start charging us for using our own ATMs.
As we record on Thursday.
Yeah, and I remember in the UK the banks tried to do that. And
there was a big public backlash.
Yeah, and you know, I'd like to see that here, that there's public backlash. One thing that does worry me about this whole situation with the ATMs is that I spoke to someone recently who works in one of the banks, and they said that they all use the same network for the ATMs. So there shouldn't be...
The back end network shouldn't
be any cost whatsoever.
Well, there shouldn't be a cost to them, but this is always the defence, that they absorbed all the costs of developing the network and all of those things.
I think we've paid for it by now, though.
Yeah, that's much more consumer debate, isn't it?
I know, sorry, just going off on a tangent there.
You're listening to The Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. For these stories and more, go to mumbrella.com.au. Next, Ben Elton sinks a little bit more. So Ben Elton's live from Planet Earth dropped to an audience of just 384,000 this week. That's the metro audience across the five capital cities. And that's not great. What also perhaps wasn't great PR was Ben Elton then talking about his ratings. In fact, this was just before the second show went to air. And he kind of said, well, you know, if ratings and knee-jerk reactions matter, then, hey, Hitler was right. Let's hear that clip.
Funny that Australian public play the ratings game. I mean, I don't think they do, actually. I mean, nowhere else in the world does everybody sort of say, hey, they're betting on this number of viewers or that. I think it's because the pool is so small. You can almost, you know, here we are, we live in this, we're trying to defend our own industry, but actually we're also eating it at the same time. Channel 9 have given me absolutely no cut-off figure, but can I just say, you know, good work doesn't necessarily, you know, if numbers are what matter and first-time knee-jerk reactions are what matters, well then Hitler stands vindicated, you know? A good piece of work, you know, I just wonder whether what it would have been like, you know, when, you know, the first night of Hamlet, if Twitter had been around, you know, 5 minutes in, bored already, well, lighten up, you Danish swine, well, you know.
That's not a bad opening routine. You could have a go at the critics in your opening monologue.
Well, having a go at the critics, but I do think this idea that something has to be judged instantly, sort of gladiatorial thumb up or thumb down, is astonishing. You know, you couldn't do that to a good album, you couldn't do that to a good film, and you can't do it to good comedy. And as I say, all my comedy has taken a bit of time to bed in. I mean, the young ones, I have to tell it took 3 years.
So it does say quite a lot, doesn't it, when not only do you compare your critics to Hitler, but yourself to Shakespeare?
As I said, if you've got nothing to give people, then you attack people. I think, look, I like Ben Elton. I spoke about it last week. I just think, I think there's part of the show that's just not connecting with the audience. And I think, as you said last week, it'll probably drop soon.
Which
is a shame because, and I'll still defend it because it's not a food show. It's not a, you know, it's not a reality show. It's live sketch shows with some young comics, and you know, there's a team writing it, and it's not just Ben Elton, as far as I'm aware.
I think one of the issues some people raise is that if there was a wider team on the writing side, rather than just on the, you know, present the appearing on screen side, then maybe that would help a bit.
Maybe.
But now you saw the first episode, which I didn't. I saw the second episode,
I missed the second,
actually stick with it the whole way through. But one thing that really did strike me is for a live show, very, very professionally produced and delivered.
It feels scripted continually. It's funny, it doesn't feel live.
Yeah, it doesn't have the holes that a live show has.
Yeah,
sometimes.
You know, it needs something to happen on it where you go...
That feels dangerous and live, perhaps. But to me, I see it as a positive. You know, well done that they put together such a professionally live show.
To me, live is chaotic.
Mm.
It reminds me of The Big Breakfast in the UK was live and chaotic.
Yes.
You never knew what was going to happen.
Yes, saw a bit more behind the scenes, perhaps. Someone made the point that obviously the other newest show is Adam Hill's Gordon Street Tonight, yeah. which actually is pre-recorded, but someone was saying feels more live mm. than Ben Elton, which actually is live. But yeah, we'll...
I think what they need is somebody to stuff up on stage when they're doing live. I think that's what it needs. Somebody fall, just something to happen that makes you go, oh, this is live.
Are we beyond that now? Is there hope for it?
Look, I hope so. I like Ben Elton and I like the fact that this has given... It's something different on television at the moment. Hey, it got me to watch it, which is unusual. And I'd like to hopefully see it keep going.
Well, next, Aussie media seems to be out of public favour. So the Australian public's trust in the media is lower in Australia than in virtually any other country, suggests a recent piece of research released by Edelman Public Relations. Now, according to the survey, and there are the usual caveats over methodology and everything else, 32% of the, and I think they've described it as the informed Australian public, trusts the media, 32%, compared to a global average of 49%, and way, way below China, where it was about 80%. You, I guess, come at this from two points of view, both the PR point of view and the former journalist point of view.
First off, I'll put a disclaimer that Edelman and Flashman Hillard are obviously global agencies that compete against one another. So I don't really want to say anything negative against Edelman at the moment. The only thing that was disappointing me about the survey, I think it's been 3 years in Australia now, it's been 11 years globally, is that only 200 people were asked the questions in Australia, which seemed like a small figure. I know for a global they had over 5,000, but for 200 to come up with a global, to come up with an Australian national average with 200 surveyed seemed low.
Though, do you think that the numbers seem right? As in the actual results of the survey? Do you, for instance, think that the media in Australia deserves to be trusted by the public?
Yeah, I'm an ex-journalist. various aspects of the media, no, but I think overall the majority of people that become journalists and are journalists are good people who do it not for the money, I can tell you that. They do it because they want news to be out there.
And then they don't want to work in PR, which pays better.
There you go, see. Or sometimes you get bored doing it, being a journalist, and you move on to do other things. But I think
suddenly it almost feels like you're talking about yourself rather than.
I think that was my only concern with actual as a PR firm ourselves, we usually do, and Edelman do this as well with a lot of their other surveys. They usually survey between 1,000 to 2,500 people to get that kind of average. And I think most of the big news polls, Galaxy Research, and all that kind of stuff, they do the same. I just felt that 200. Wasn't a strong enough number to give that figure for a national average.
Well, hopefully if John Guano listens to this podcast, he's our resident commenter who will usually come in on what's statistically significant, and hopefully he'll wade in on the comment stream on this one at some point.
So on this one, I think 32% you trust in the media. Well, I think it all depends on who you've asked. And I think, if I went to my friends... who all work in the media, they'd probably all say no.
Yeah, I'm not sure they'd be statistically significant,
exactly.
Would they, if they were your friends?
So you need that, and I just don't feel as though, it doesn't feel like the average. I feel like more people I speak to trust the media. They don't trust, most people I know don't trust the government, I'll say this much.
Yeah, and that was one of the interesting things, that trust in government, actually trust in CEOs had seemed to have gone up. That was interesting. But the other thing is, whether you answer the question, no, I don't trust the media, but actually the way you behave means that you do, because obviously your own perception of your trust and what you would say can sometimes be two different things.
Yeah.
Next, KFC's unhealthy eating choice.
The pigeons called? They want their lunch back. Come on, go get a new streetwise snack from KFC. Delicious popcorn, chicken and gravy for only $1.95. Get smart, get streetwise.
So good.
So that clip, with that annoying whiny voice going on about pigeons, is KFC's latest offering promoting its popcorn chicken over what it looked like a healthy snack, if not a little boring. Now, Scott, my guess is this doesn't break any rules. I could be proved wrong.
No, I don't think it does either.
But does that make it a good tactic for a good strategy for KFC to use?
Every time I turn on television, there seems to be a KFC ad, so they're just continually doing something. The figures are up, I think, this year.
My issue with this one, though, is... bagging someone out for, you know, trying to eat a healthy choice.
My issues with the other advert with the guy on the girl. The
well, let's come back to that in a minute. Because on this one, it's not even that I have a moral problem with it as such. It's for the marketing industry as a whole, under massive pressure, particularly around, you know, healthy food choices and all of those things, it seems like it makes a really easy target for the critics.
No, absolutely. It seems like a bizarre choice because they're going to get attacked on this one. You know, they're basically saying to someone eating a sandwich and something, don't have that, go get something deep fried. And that seems like a kind of a mistake.
And what was the other ad that you mentioned?
The one is the guy, he's got a girl over at his apartment, and I like the way that all the ones that tell them what to do are all better dressed and they've got their hair done up and all that kind of stuff. So
I've not seen this one.
So it's meant to be their alter egos type thing, and they're always, you know, better looking and all that kind of stuff. So this one, the guy just basically is about to, I think he's about to phone for Thai, or he's about to do something like that, and they're like, no, don't do that, get her a KFC. And I'm thinking, what kind of madman would think, I've got this gorgeous girl on my sofa, I know what I'll do, I'll nip out and buy her a KFC, you know? I mean, that's mental. I've seen this about five times, and I'm like, you've got to be shitting me. Whoever came up with this must be insane. No man in his mind would ever do that.
Next, any other business? Scott, any other business?
I think Apple and Google's kind of current war at the moment. About allowing publishers to use their marketplaces.
This is war of the tablets.
Yeah, war of the it's not just war of the tablets though. It's war of publishing. I mean, in a sense, but Apple have their iOS, Google have their Android, and those platforms sit across many areas. Tablets
and for publishers, they're one of the decisions they have to make is okay. Maybe the iPad is going to be the savior of journalism, but if I sell a subscription, Apple's going to keep 30% of the
Well, Apple said, if you sell a subscription, it's 30% to us, and you're not allowed to link to your website, and you can't, if you already got a prior subscription, it doesn't really matter. Google have came forward and said, we'll create this platform. You can just, if you've already got a subscription elsewhere, you'll just get the digital delivery of it. We'll take 10%. But they also said, we're doing this because we don't care about making money from it, really, because we make our income elsewhere. And that was a statement that concerned me, because it felt like the Coles Woolworths against the little guys thing, where they're like, oh, we can put the milk down to a dollar and then leave it there, and people will just go, oh, great, thank you, that's cheap as chips. But, you know, in 5 years' time, they might change that.
And who do you think will win the war?
I don't actually think there's a war. I think the
battle between Google and Apple.
I don't see there being a winner per se. I think the fact is that Apple, who sell Google's Android, which I think is across now 70, 80 devices, where the tablets come out to be 100 devices, whereas Apple's iOS sits across iPhone 3, 3GS, 4, the 5 when it comes out, and iPads. That's it. So it'll be sent across 5 or 6 devices. However, per revenue, Apple are making an absolute killing over everybody else. So even though they've got less devices for sale, less the marketplace is just at 2 billion downloads. I think that both of them will keep going, and people will keep buying an Apple because they want a closed, safe system, and people will use Android who want that open system that's not actually open but open-ish.
As you can hear, as Scott's voice gradually got quieter and quieter, he just went on and on about Apple and Google. So in the end, we just had to fade him out. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much to my co-host, Scott Rohde.
Thanks, Tim.
And to our guest for today, Duncan Campbell.
Lots of fun. Thanks very much.
For these stories and more, go to mumbrella.com.au. Production was by Georgina Pearson. That was the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Toodle-pip.